Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Dimmi quando tu verrai. Dimmi quando, quando, quando. L'anno, il giorno e l'ora in cui forse tu mi bacerai. Ogni istante attenderai. Fino a quando, quando, quando.
This is very much one of the songs, one of the joys of the Netflix limited series, or maybe unlimited series, possibly, Ripley, is the kind of lush 50s and 60s Italian pop music that gets played around there, especially this particular song, Quando, 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 by Tony Renis. My house is divided right now about Ripley. I kind of like it. The other person with whom I share a life does not. But we're both walking around the house singing Quando, Quando, Quando a great deal of the time. So it's time to do the nose. Time for me to stop babbling. Time for me to introduce the panel. We're going to go with a slightly smaller panel today. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. She's the author of The Essays Only You Can Write, which is also rumored to be getting adapted by Netflix. Andrew Scott may be in that as well. His name has been linked to it. Don't know too much about the project. Lindsay Lee Wallace writes about culture, healthcare, and health equity, and other stuff too. We're thrilled to have both of them with us. And let us introduce you also to the talented Mr. Ripley. Although that is not the name of this particular adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith intellectual property. This one is just called Ripley. You're going to hear Johnny Flynn, who, by the way, well, I'll mention this later. Never mind. Johnny Flynn as Dickie Greenleaf. He's the rich guy to whom Andrew Scott has attached himself like a remora. Andrew Scott is Tom Ripley. We'll hear the two of them talking. A one maestro.
So what's the plan? Rome? Sicily? I mean, you really can't go wrong, whatever you decide.
I brought you some things from New York.
What?
Some shirts and things, a robe. They're at the hotel. I have a confession to make. Your father sent me here to try to convince you to go home.
My father?
Yeah. And I told him I'd try, and I meant it, but I have no intention of doing that now. I completely understand why you'd want to stay here. Why anyone would. It's perfect. Why would you want to go back to New York?
He sent you, like, paid your way?
Yeah. But I'm going to pay him back. I'm not someone who takes advantage of people.
How do you even know him?
I don't. He found me. I guess he couldn't convince any of your real friends to interfere in your life. And I'm not going to either. But you should have the clothes that your mother had me bring. And then I guess I'll leave.
So the main voice you hear there is Andrew Scott. You may remember him as the hot priest, the so-called hot priest in Fleabag. You may also remember him as Moriarty. So in the, you know, the Sherlock Holmes adaptation. And my headphones, I'm alarmed to say, have gone dead here. That's not a good sign. Okay, so in the adaptation that features Benedict Cumberbatch. So let's hear from the panel. Hopefully I can hear from the panel. And we're going to maybe begin by taking everybody's temperature about this. Irene Papoulis, maybe begin and let us know what it is that you're thinking right now about the series. I know that you watched the earlier adaptation, the so-called Matt Damon one, a while ago. How's it going now?
I love this one. I thought it was fantastic. I basically loved every minute of it. I love the slowness. I love the acting. I love the story. I love the morality. I love the, you know, the visuals, all the art, all the statues, you know, all the close-ups. At first I thought, you know, why take 8 episodes to tell this story? It doesn't make any sense. It's too much time. But when I saw how slowly they were sort of developing everything and why they might be doing that, I started to just like relax into it and absolutely love it. Like, I wanted to look at those statues for, you know, 30 seconds before they went on to the next thing and et cetera. So I actually really loved it.
Yeah, just staying with you for a second on this. I think there is a reasonable person might decide that 8 episodes of this is too much. It just is too long. But I'm kind of having a similar reaction to you. First of all, this thing is just, it is the cinematography, and that's what it is. This isn't cinema, but the cinematography by Robert Elsmid, who's shot pretty much all of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies. This is a movie cinematographer just letting it all fly in this amazing black and white format. So, yeah, you can sit there and just rewind stuff and watch it like a series of postcards. It's so terrific. And I think also there's something about the arduousness of being a psychopath. You know, it's like you just realize it's really hard work to be a psychopath. You have to like go back.
Yes.
You have to go back to the car because you forgot. It's so hard to get there, you know, and there's stairs and there's a cat. And it's just like so hard. And I think, you know, some of that, just the intensive, almost Augean labor of being a psychopath is brought to life.
It's right. It's putting it in your face. You know, It's not just you can't just like do the act and then move on. You have to think about all the details of the act. You have to be with him in all the details of the act in a way that's just chilling in an interesting way. And it has a moral, it has a moral message, I think, which maybe we can get to later.
Yeah. I'll be interested. To hear what your moral message is on this. Cause I think we are going to sort of get into the OJ lane a little bit here, maybe near the end of our conversation. But Lindsay, we haven't checked in with you yet. Tell us what you're thinking about Ripley right now.
I also really enjoyed Ripley. I feel like speaking to the arduousness of being a psychopath and committing, you know, a combination of extravagant and extremely petty crimes constantly as your lifestyle, I was really struck by how, because, you know, we're in this era of like constant remakes and, you know, adaptations of things that previously existed. And there's always the question when there's a new one of like, sort of, as you were saying before, do we really even need this? And I think that it's so surprisingly charming how completely off-putting Andrew Scott is in this role the entire time. Obviously, you know, it's important for him to be charming enough that he worms his way into this dynamic in the first place, but it takes a long time for him to do anything that I find at all charming. And that really speaks to how awkward he is and how much this is his lifestyle because he's incapable of doing anything else. And that really makes it feel very lonely and sad, which I enjoyed a lot. And definitely, I think, was set off by like how simultaneously beautiful and spare all of the imagery is.
Yeah, we should say that over nearly 7 decades, Tom Ripley has appeared in 5 books by Patricia Highsmith, 5 films, multiple television episodes, and even a radio show. He's been played by Matt Damon, Alain Delon, Dennis Hopper, John Malkovich, and now Andrew Scott. But Lindsay, I agree with you. Not that I've seen every one of those adaptations, but I feel like this is the saddest Ripley I can imagine. This is Andrew Scott Ripley. And the person with whom I share a life also shared your sense that he's so charmless at first. You know, he rarely even smiles when he's making his first overtures to Dickie Greenleaf and to Marge, that you sort of wonder, how does he even achieve the insertion he makes into their lives? Why would you welcome this guy? He's just such a bummer.
Yeah, I feel like it, you know, we've had also sort of this wave of stories about like charming grifters, like Anna Delvey, for example. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of an example of the reason that you let this person into your life has everything to do with you and very little to do with them, because I would not want this man in my home. But I don't have anything that he would want to steal from me. So I guess that would work out mutually between us.
I what you just said, what a great observation. When you let him into your life, it says more about you. Yes, and I think that's sort of true with the two people we see here, Dickie and Marge. There are some things wrong between them that we can just barely sense. And just some emptiness that apparently they think, or at least Dickie thinks Tom Ripley might fill. Irene, we should talk about the black and white and about the cinematography. We've already kind of touched upon it, but there are some people who don't like it, some people who don't like black and white at all. But say a little bit about how you're seeing it. Yeah,
I'll get to that in 1 second. Can I just say one thing about the other thing? Yeah. I mean, I think the openness, like the gullibleness of, it's true that Dickie is sort of bored with his life. So, oh, here's another person. Let me invite him into my life. Let me sort of demonstrate what a great life, in fact, it is. Yeah, sure, you can stay in my house. You know, so there's a certain gullibleness, but it's also, yeah, I guess I'm agreeing with you, Lindsay, about, you know, he wants to be magnanimous and the kind of guy that just has people coming in and out of his house all the time. And why not? And he's gullible. He's nothing to lose, he thinks, you know. Yeah. But and that's interesting. I mean, what's his name? Jude Law was so good in the other movie that it was sort of it's hard to do as well as Jude Law in that role. But I was kind of thinking about him too when I thought of the role. But yeah. Yeah, okay, so black and white.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is also very, very true and very, very interesting. That whole idea that, I mean, I went to college with a lot of people who'd grown up with considerable wealth and privilege. And one thing about a lot of them, and I see this sometimes in our governor, Ned Lamont, too, people like that, they kind of expect that people are going to be nice to them because for the most part, people have been nice to them. Like they've had a lot of people in their lives, you know, at their country clubs or wherever else who are paid to be nice to them. And so they're always a little surprised, I think, when it turns out that some people aren't nice. But anyway,
yes.
Go ahead.
Exactly. And they always have extra guest rooms in their houses, you know, no big deal. Yeah. Just take the room that somebody will clean up for you.
It's very Saltburn, you know, I mean, of course you can stay here.
Yeah. Right, I mean, you need to have been afforded a really significant amount of good fortune and privilege to assume that everyone who comes by you means the best. And I think you can really see that in certain people.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, and you brought up Saltburn. When I watched The Talented Mr. Ripley again, I saw Saltburn differently, but that's another, I guess that's sort of beside the point of where we are right now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We can keep talking about this. I don't care. We've all seen, I think we've all seen Saltburn too. Yeah, go ahead.
It's such a 2024 take on The Talented Mr. Ripley. You know, like I felt like the original movie to an extent and this one to a greater extent has such a wonderful morality, backbone of morality, at least as I would see it. And to me, that's connected with the black and white and with all the elements from 1961 and everything. Like it's sort of a moral, a belief in law in a way that Saltburn just completely threw out the window. Something bothered me about Saltburn when I saw it. And I felt that this kind of brought it into perspective because it's a very similar story. She must have been thinking about this movie when she wrote that one. But it's such a very bleak take on it.
Yeah, I don't know. Lizzie, you've seen Saltburn, right?
I have, and I adore Saltburn. I feel like a critique that I've heard of Saltburn, and I don't know, Irene, if this is part of like what's that wrong with you about it or not, but the critique that I've heard of it is this idea of like, oh, it's demonizing of, you know, the working class or demonizing of the middle class or whoever you want to say the protagonist of Saltburn, whatever class you want to say he belongs to, in his like his grandiose grotesque efforts to achieve social mobility. And I think that rather than like seeing that story as one that has a clear moral, it's more just about like the decadence of the wealthy and the trusting nature of people who have never had reason to believe anyone could or would hurt them. And then the immense amount of effort, like we were saying previously, that goes into scheming and plotting, which can be rewarding to watch all on its own. But it's interesting, like aesthetically, Saltburn is like this like orgy of ridiculous scenery. And this comparatively Ripley is so pared down, but ultimately, yeah, as you were saying, it's a very similar story.
You know, Irene, I'm curious because I didn't rewatch the old Matt Damon one. But one of the things that I thought about in terms of Saltburn and what I think I remember about the Matt Damon Talented Mr. Ripley is that I find kind of absent in this is a longing for. I mean, Barry Keoghan's character in Saltburn. You know, he initially is so in love, so smitten with this young lord that he, you know, will literally drink his bathwater with special extra ingredient that we won't talk about. You know, and my recollection of Matt Damon was that he really does sort of appear to have a crush on the Jude Law character. I don't see that with the Adam Scott Ripley. There's a little bit of an interest, but the interest is more about achieving control and maybe taking Marge's place, Dakota Fanning's place. But I don't know. I don't see that yearning quite the same way. But I'd love to hear your read on it, Irene.
I have to agree with you. I mean, but it's more of a yearning to be him, but not to be with the girlfriend. You know, it's so, you know, you could. I think the hints are very, very subtle in this. And it was also the case with Matt Damon. I didn't necessarily feel the yearning in him like we feel in Saltburn. It's more the yearning for the life. It's for the glitz and the money and the opportunities than for the for the person. I don't know, but there are definitely many hints of it though in this one.
We should, Lindsay, maybe talk a little bit more about the visual aesthetic here. I'm finding it remarkable. I would just turn the sound off and put some music on and just, you know, watch all this stuff. I mean, everything from the just incredible use of Italy as mise-en-scène to just little things like rain hitting a wall by the ocean or something. It just, like, everything's kind of fun to look at.
So much so. I know that this is like when I was watching it with my partner, we both just kept being like, God, look at the thingness of all these things. They're really just resonating with, you know, how much they're sitting on the table or next to the ocean or whatever. And Irene, you mentioned the statues before, and I love how especially, you know, how many of the statues are two-faced or they're, you know, eroded or something as the plot goes on and we see like more and more mutilated or unsettling statues. And I feel like it's really gratifying how much they are saying, like, we're going to linger on this. You're going to look at this symbolism and we're not going to worry about, you know, oh, is this heavy handed? No, it's beautiful. And we've shot it beautifully and please enjoy it. And I am enjoying it.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Go ahead. Yeah. Well, I was going to say it's like, there's a judgment, like art is there. Art is watching you, you know, that's part of where I feel the morality, you know. Art is watching you. Art is what, and he loves Caravaggio. I actually had to look up. I didn't realize that Caravaggio also had that past with you know, a potentially murderous past. I didn't know that. The fact that he was inspired by that, the fact that he wanted to just look at the paintings, like we are looking at him, like we are looking at the statues, was, you know, was I thought wonderful. And we were like, they were all everything was watching, you know, even the cat. It was so great. Yeah. The cat in the bottom, you know, the bottom floor, watching that elevator go up and down with a sense of judgment. Like it couldn't speak, you know, it couldn't tell the truth. It couldn't tell what it saw, that cat, but it was there giving in judgment, just like the statues were and the paintings and all the images that we were lingering on. You know, they were part of the story.
Yeah, there's a great Caravaggio moment. It's in they're in the Galleria Borghese, and they're looking at a painting, and there's a guide talking. And what he says is that Caravaggio shows you the connection between the perpetrator and the victim. This is going to do a beheading there. And you can kind of see Ripley's circuits light up a little bit. It's not 100% clear how they're lighting up, but he's kind of thinking, oh yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing too, actually.
Yeah, but I feel like, because we were talking about yearning before, and I feel like it really speaks to, like, he has this, he's so charmless, and he, like, seems almost like he's driven to do the things that he does because he just, like, can't think of another option rather than because he has some goal in mind. But it feels like when he's engaging with the art or when he's engaging with Dickie, it's like an abstract yearning to understand what it would be like to feel strongly enough to, like, desire a person or to create a piece of art or something. Like, it's not a yearning for something specific, it's a yearning to know what it would be like to be a person almost. And it's, like, very sad.
That's true. Like, he's so embarrassed because his taste in robes is not admired, you know, is disdained. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess we have to, I was going to segue over to OJ, but I think maybe we have to, since you're bringing up the taste in robes, really do have to talk about Freddie. If you've seen The Talented Mr. Ripley, you know that this is just this incredible, just, you know, cherry bomb of a performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman. He plays the whole thing very differently. Instead, what we get here is a very different thing, played by the non-binary offspring of Sting and Trudy Styler doing a kind of just a remarkably interesting performance. And we should say, for those people who don't know the material, this is not a spoiler, Freddie is a friend, a rich friend of the rich people who are being victimized and mined for everything they've got by Ripley. And Freddie kind of sees through in a very different way who and what a Ripley really is, and very quickly picks up some cues. So Elliot Sumner, who is the offspring of, as I said, Sting and Trudy. So I don't know. I mean, Irene, maybe you go first and then Lizzie, just because you recently saw Philip Seymour Hoffman do this same part.
Oh, yeah. It's different, but it has the same, this character has the same shrewdness. And I thought it was interesting to say, wait a minute, is that a woman playing it? No, it's not exactly a woman. It's a man. Oh, okay. So it's this person is non-binary. Okay. And so it gives an interesting edge to the character. But I think they do a fantastic job of play, you know, it's sort of like the spirit of female Philip Seymour Hoffman with such a very, very different affect. But like sort of a classic type.
Well, you know what I also, Lizzie, what I also thought about Elias Sumner was they were doing a pretty amazing performance alive, but they also seem to have to do a lot of work dead too. I don't know how much of that can be done with dummies, but a lot of times you can see Elliot Sumner's, I guess this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I mean, come on.
It's the opening scene too.
It's like Weekend at Bernie's or something. It just kind of just goes and goes. And Lindsay, I was thinking that was probably very hard work for both Andrew Scott, but maybe especially for young Elliot Sumner.
I was wondering how much of that was done with dummies as well. And then I was thinking about whether there's like a special coach somewhere in Hollywood who teaches you how to be a dead body. I want to find that person and have a conversation with them. But yeah, I think it also sort of, because Elliot Sumner in this role is so immediately clocking Andrew Scott as an outsider and as somebody who's lying about himself. And it feels a little bit like this moment of like game recognizes game. You wonder like Elliot Sumner's character that, you know, Freddie really is from money, but if we're, you know, extrapolating like this is a non-binary actor and this character is being, you know, accepted by these other wealthy people despite their gender transgression, what does that mean for what Freddie has had to do to, you know, ingratiate himself with Dickie and with Marge and with this level of people? And then we see, not, I guess, another, when the police are investigating what's happened to Freddie, we see that, you know, Freddie has this male lover in his bed. And then you're thinking, okay, well, if Tom is so terrified of what it is to yearn or what it is to have a relationship, to get close to another person. And meanwhile, Freddie is, you know, having relationships with people and being accepted into society, is the difference just that Freddie has always had money? Is the difference that Freddie is a better, more effective grifter than Tom is? And it's interesting what an actor can bring to a role like that through their own identity.
Yes, a remarkable performance.
Wow, we're gonna have that's to, interesting.
We have to stop there. I have to throw to a little bit of pledge break. Please be generous. Very important on this drive for us.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygening it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed. And in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
We are back. This is The Nose. With me today, Irene Papoulas teaches writing at Trinity College and the author of The Essays Only You Can Write. Lindsay Lee Wallace writes about culture, healthcare, and health equity, and other stuff too. So this week, the word came forth that in Europe, in godless Europe, there'll be a new version of Scrabble called Scrabble Together. I think the way that it works, I've read a lot of articles about this now, but I think the way that it works is you get the regular Scrabble game, the so-called classic Scrabble game, but then you can turn the board over and there's a different side over there, and it's more collaborative, and it's faster paced, and it's more accessible. I don't really know why it's more accessible. I was not able to figure that out. But there's an emphasis on teamwork, collaboration, and working towards a fun goal together. Everything that maybe a new generation of potential Scrabble players who are playing lots and lots of word games online already may want or need. So, Lindsay, having talked to a lot of people from your generation about this, I'm guessing Scrabble isn't that big a thing in your life as it stands right now.
I would actually say that I play more Scrabble now than I did growing up, but that's still almost no Scrabble. I think Bananagrams is a bigger part of my life than Scrabble is. I think Scrabble is like one of those things that when you're like a bookish child, all of your parents' friends get you Scrabble or like a weird diary from Walmart or the third installment in a fantasy series that you've never heard of. So I have a lot of Scrabble. But I would say I prefer Bananagrams. I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about this new version if I can ever get my hands on it.
Right. I'm sure people coming back from Europe will be happy to pick one up for you and slip it into their suitcases like a stolen Picasso.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe you could just quickly, Lindsay, because this came up in one of our meetings and Lily Tyson, our senior producer, said exactly what you just said. But I don't really, I mean, I had to look up Bananagrams. It's sort of Scrabble with no board or something, right?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I feel like I'm going to reveal how little I know about the rules of Scrabble. But I feel like Bananagrams is a lot more, it's easier to, you know, toss in your bag. It's easier to be like, oh, let's play a quick round of Bananagrams. I sound like I'm a lot of fun at parties right now. But yeah, I think you basically, you divide up the letters and then you can build sort of in any direction. You're not collaborating with the other person. You're each making your own grid. And then whoever finishes first wins. And I think it's more creative and you can break it down and start over again at any point that you want to.
Right. I mean, all this stuff is kind of generational. I'm thinking about marketing a new version of Twister, but just for people with artificial joints. You know, I think those of us who've had knee replacements and stuff, we need our own Twister. But so Irene, I don't know. We should say that just in the fashion of Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss and all kinds of things like that, this has been seized upon in the culture wars. I mean, not fervidly, but the commentators from the right have seized this change, which is not even happening here on American soil anyway, as further proof that everything is getting soft and blurry and people aren't learning the rules of things and this is all bad and our country will go to hell in a handbasket if people don't play Scrabble the way God intended. I could probably guess what you think about that, but I'd love to hear it.
I think they're absolutely right. No, just kidding. You know, I mean, but I don't really, I love, you know, I definitely grew up, my son is kind of like Lindsay and his attitude about Scrabble. And yes, he you know, busted as being one of those parents that said, don't you want to play Scrabble? Come on, let's play. And he was never really very interested in it, but he and his cousins used to play Boggle all the time and Bananagrams and things like that. But I grew up playing Scrabble a lot and having a pretty cutthroat family when it comes to Scrabble. So sometimes when we get together, we still play it and we really enjoy it. I mean, and I had, you know, my sort of relative, we called her Big Irene because she was older than me. And she has to this day has the scores from that game we had in 1978, you know. And so I love Scrabble, but not everyone has to. And I'm okay if people don't. But I think it's interesting that, you know, the whole idea of that the quote unquote younger generations don't want to be cutthroat explicitly. You know, the whole idea about competitiveness, I think, is interesting. Our relationships to it. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I mean, Lindsay, I think, you know, prior to the show, you alluded to the fact that when you do play Bananagrams, you play for keeps.
I think it's interesting. Part of the idea being that, you know, younger people are less competitive. I personally play Bananagrams like it's deciding whether or not I'm going to get to keep Dickie's fortune. So that's a serious game for me. But I think definitely like, at the same time, I'm much less likely to like actually, you know, get involved in the kind of serious argument that people are known to have over board games than I think some older members of my family might be. But I don't think that that's necessarily because my generation is less competitive. I think it's more like the competition is kind of, we know that we're supposed to be less competitive, and we grew up, you know, in the age of everybody gets a trophy for participating, which has been extensively, you know, examined as the reason that we're all such losers or something like that. But I actually think that it mainly has just led to a kind of internalized shame about being competitive, that I feel competitive with my peers about, you know, what we are able to achieve in our lives. But I also feel really bad about that competitiveness. And maybe if I could vent it through Scrabble, then I would actually be happier.
I just do want to chime in about the cultural critique that goes on at times like this, because you will see this. I was looking today to see if the National Review had done its article yet. Apparently not. But there's going to be one. And one of the things that they're going to say is that, yes, I mean, it's important to learn how to compete and follow rules and follow the rules that are there. And that's how you achieve mastery of it, too. You have to, all this kind of stuff. Kind of conveniently ignoring the fact that we now have a probable Republican nominee for president who cheats at golf, and like really cheats at golf, and when he's lost an election, will not accept the results of this.
And those are two comparable problems with him. Cheats at golf, won't accept the election results. Same level.
Yeah. So I don't know. Well, yeah, go ahead. Irene. Yes, please.
I was going to say that there's, you know, what Lindsay said about, like, in a way, you know, feeling shame about their competitiveness or about your competitiveness is sort of connected to that in some way. Like let's see, how does that fit with Trump cheating at golf and the election? I'm not sure, but I think the idea because we can condemn that, but I think I do notice in students too that their competitiveness is embarrassing to them. So they try to hide it, but that makes it worse. And that makes you, you know, the end of that road is Ripley, you know, like just pretending something, you know, is always pretending. You know, why not be a little bit more open about your competitiveness? And then you can, if you recognize it, you can, I don't know where I'm going with this. Maybe it's not true, but it just seems like there's something about being embarrassed by competitiveness that seems really problematic. Yeah. Go ahead.
There's a lot of embarrassment in being seen to have to try to do something no matter what it is. And obviously competitiveness, if you win, then, you know, you were competitive and it brought you victory and good for you. But if you're competitive and you lose, then that's extremely embarrassing. And, you know, there are like all kinds of, like the example of this that I think about really frequently is like the predominant makeup trend about looking like you're not wearing any makeup. There's this like clean girl aesthetic that you can achieve via like 15 separate products. And I think the whole point of it is to say like, I didn't put any effort into this, and competitiveness is effort and effort is off-putting.
So why is it embarrassing to put in effort?
I mean, I think because if you put in effort and you don't achieve your ends, then that is inherently embarrassing for Ripley, for me personally. But I do wonder at, you know, that being a cultural difference, because I think that I imagine that that's true for people across generations. I'm not sure.
You know, when
you're exposed for trying, you know, you're exposed for caring, you know, that's all I can think of is why it would be embarrassing. Like, because
and for
if you
not
care,
being inherently talented.
I think there there are class distinctions to all this too. I think, and you know, you could sort of go from Ripley and look out to the world of Dickie Greenleaf. But yeah, I was even thinking of Room with a View, where they're all playing tennis and they're not taking it terribly seriously. And in Saltburn, they're playing tennis and smoking and drinking champagne at the same time. There's that kind of idea that you don't try that hard. I will say this: when my son was growing up, I used to take him and a bunch of kids. They were all like 10, 11, 12. To a soccer field on Sundays, and we would play soccer. And I had a rule that I would just announce suddenly, next goal wins. And at first they were shocked by that, because what if we were ahead 4-0 and I say next goal wins? And I was so pleased after a while to see like some new kids come on board with us, and one of the new kids would say 1-0 when the first goal was scored, and another kid who was kind of hip to the system would say, no, we don't do that. you know, because it does take the pressure of like who's going to win. You can just play for fun at that point. We have to take a little break here, and we will come back. We will make some endorsements and recommendations.
I started off with vigor, you responded with dismay. Then I tried to make amends, except I didn't have an A. So I settled for plain men's, which gave me 12 points more. You see, the D had landed on a triple letter score. We're playing Scrabble. We are obsessed. It's been 3 hours now and I'm getting depressed. 'Cause all I've got is consonants.
And we are back. Time to say some thank yous, starting with our technical producer. It's the maestro, Dylan Reyes, is here with us today. The producer of The Nose, pretty much all the time, is Jonathan McPants. Thanks to both of them for today. Thanks to our great panel also. They're going to make some endorsements for you, or to you, or something, wherever you make endorsements right now. Lindsay Lee Wallace, do you want to get us going on this?
Sure. My first endorsement is the film Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney, which is a fantastic return to the nunsploitation genre. it's really bloody and gory and ridiculous, and I had a great time watching it. And I wanted to forgo my other recommendation to point out also that Dickie is painting very poorly, and he's completely comfortable with being a bad painter because his wealth has afforded him the right to appear to try, and if he fails, it's okay because there are no consequences for him because his life is so cloistered and protected. And that is my other recommendation, is just to think about that. So those are my recommendations.
You know, when you say that, I think about 30 Rock. And the episode with John Hamm, I think it was called The Bubble. And the whole premise was that John Hamm, not because he was so rich and powerful, but because he was so handsome, was never told that he thought he could play tennis and he couldn't play tennis. He thought he was good at all kinds of things, including sex, that he wasn't good at. But nobody had ever told him that, because everybody was just so happy to have him walk into the restaurant and get a good table because he's so great looking. So, yeah, I get that. I don't identify, but I get it. So, Irene, how about you?
Well, actually, I also have one apropos of our discussion, which is, you know, I would want to endorse being proud of trying hard, because it's good to try hard. And then that's how you can change and grow. But I would also say, definitely, if you want to watch Ripley, it's very good to watch The Talented Mr. Ripley before it. And in particular, Gwyneth Paltrow's performance in that, I thought was really good. I mean, I kind of feel like she's underrated as an actress. I know a lot of people disagree with me, but there's a scene where she's crying and she's, you know, it was such a wonderful scene of crying. And she just, I thought, did a fantastic job in that movie, maybe underrated. And I also want to endorse the Samba Fest at Trinity College, which is coming up on the 20th, April 20th, a week from Saturday. It's going to be 11 to 6, rain or shine. It's totally free. Lots of Brazilian drumming, steel pan, a Brazilian jazz singer named Teca, other musicians, drumming, dance, food trucks, face painting, and a good time. And it's all free at the Trinity College campus. And you can just Google Trinity College Samba Fest for more information.
I think Mr. McPants agrees with you about Gwyneth Paltrow. I thought she was really good in Shakespeare in Love, too. I mean, I think the Goop stuff really kind of got in the way with
I know. Why did she stop acting? She should just go back to acting and forget the goop.
Or stop skiing.
Yeah, doesn't she know that grifting is for poor people? Didn't she learn that from
I do want to quickly say that right not too long after The Talented Mr. Ripley came out, I don't know exactly when it came out, but this must what happened in 2000, which is that I ran in to Philip Seymour Hoffman at a kind of drunken party at the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. I was covering it. He was supposedly trying to make some kind of documentary or anything or something. Anyway, the rule is you never go up to celebrities and try to tell them how much you liked a particular thing that they did. But it was kind of late at night. And I thought, and I probably had a few drinks, and I thought, I think I'll tell Philip Seymour Hoffman how much I like him as Freddie in The Talented Mr. Ripley. And he pretty much like ran away from me. You know, I was like so much the person he didn't want to talk to at that particular moment. So I would like to endorse, whenever you meet a famous person, all you can really say is, I'm a big fan. And then you shut up. That's all you say. They love that when you say that. Don't say anything else. I will quickly say that I will recommend at the Goodspeed Opera House, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. I saw it on sort of the opening of its previews. I saw it because next week I'm going to record an interview with Rupert Holmes, who wrote this musical. He also wrote a very, very famous pop song, which is both beloved and hated by many people. And we will deal with that as well. I've talked to Rupert before. He's just a lot of fun to talk to. But the musical is so much fun. It's based on an uncompleted Dickens work, and they kind of lean into that, and they have the audience participate in figuring out how this could end on any given night. So it's a little bit of that kind of open-ended thing, and you know, decided by applause and stuff like that. And the cast is wonderful, and I saw it really, I think, the first time they were doing it for a full audience, and they were having so much fun. It's rare that you can see, you could be in an audience that is having fun and then look up on stage and the people on stage are having every bit as much fun, if not more, than you are, and getting a kick out of this whole interactive thing. So we will air the Rupert Holmes interview a little bit later. I'm going to record it next week. It'll probably be up the following week. And I would also say that fairly soon on the nose, I think we're going to talk about Manhunt. Manhunt is it's on Apple Plus. It is about the search for John Wilkes Booth. It is... I guess people who, I'm about to have lunch tomorrow with a real history buff who doesn't like this, but I'm just knocked out by it. Tobias Menzies, a wonderful British actor, plays Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, who's in charge of tracking down Booth. And Booth is played by actually a Northern Irish actor named, I think, Anthony Boyle. So yeah, it is. We're going to talk about that next week, and plus Alex Garland's Civil War. But when you watch Manhunt, you realize how close we came, how close this country came after the assassination of Lincoln to a full destabilization. And then you realize how close we are right now. And it's a little bit scary. And I would say Manhunt doesn't shy away from this either. I mean, it really doesn't shy away from this. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. Thanks to our great panel of Irene and Lindsay. We will be back. We will be back next week with a whole bunch of new shows. Burning, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.